So today is a different day to yesterday. As you know, yesterday was all about investing and the Business Owner Fund. We saw Wix, which was one of our investments, and then did the Q&A. Today is a completely different day where I'm not the center of attention, but you guys are. And the day is really dedicated to what I call emerging managers, so people who either have very recently started a fund, or more importantly, those of them who are dreaming of starting a fund. The way this day came about was when I, a lot of people read my letters, and increasingly people would reach out to me and ask me, how did I get started, and what should they do? And it was sort of becoming a little bit too much to speak to all of these people individually. So Michael Birkel, a good friend of mine, once said, well, why not just get them all together in one room, and then they can all see you at one time, and more importantly, they can also see each other. And I thought that was a great idea, and so that's the reason this day came about. Sometimes people ask me as well what my motivation is. I feel very strongly that I've benefited very much from my network until 2 years ago. RV Capital was a one-man firm, which meant that all of the exchanges I had were with people in my network, and since a year and a half, we're a two-man firm with Andreas. But both Andreas and I really enjoy and value the exchange with other people, and thank all of you, or many of you, for that. But of course, if you want to have a great network, you have to make sure the network thrives. And so that's a little bit our motivation as well to help many of you get started. So that's enough about today and the event. We're going to have, maybe just quickly on the schedule, we're going to have three panels this morning. So from 9 until 9:40, then there'll be a 20-minute coffee break. And then the next one will be from 10 until 10:40 with another 20-minute coffee break. And then the last one from 11 to 11:40, from 11:20 to 11:40 and until 12 o'clock. And then 12 o'clock is when we finish. I've got a feeling I might have garbled that a little bit, but hopefully you know what I mean, and if not, we'll at the end of the panels say when the next one starts. So there's going to be three panels. The first one, which I'll introduce very soon, is the Emerging Manager panel, made up of three youngish emerging managers who recently started a fund, who I've valued having an exchange of ideas with, and where they're going to talk a little bit about their journey and pass on some advice to younger or investment managers who are earlier in their stage, which is maybe a little bit more relevant than mine. My any advice I could give would have been from sort of 15, 20 years ago, whereas they've lived through this much more recently. Then the second panel, which will be at 10 o'clock, for the first time, that's going to be a panel which isn't moderated by me. It's going to be moderated by my eldest daughter, Amelie. And that's about women in investing. All of you will have noticed that investing events, including this one, tend to attract a disproportionately high number of men. And so I'm curious about what they make of that, and what sort of conclusions and lessons they can share with us. And then the final panel will be made up of three capital allocators, so allocators who allocate money to young managers or to investment managers in general. And it's an opportunity for you guys to ask them, what type of qualities do you look for in a manager, and what are the pitfalls to avoid, and so on and so forth. So, so much for today's structure, and let's get straight into the panel. We've got three people here, and maybe I'll ask each of you just to briefly introduce yourselves. I'll then ask probably a handful of questions, and then the mics will go around so that all of you can ask your questions. So Tim, why don't we start with you? Maybe you could tell us a little bit about who you are, where you're from, and what your fund is.
Hey, thanks for having me, Rob. So my name's Tim Liu, and I'm the founder of Meditation Capital, which I launched in May 2022.
Congratulations. Round of applause for that, huh?
So I was born in China, and I know Rob really likes Chinese, so he specifically asked about that point. So I was born in China, and I moved to the US when I was four, and so grew up in the US, and then went to college, and then spent 10 years in the hedge fund industry. And for a long time, I wanted to launch a fund, but didn't have like a clearly differentiated strategy. And then one day when I was looking through all the investments I tended to like. A clear pattern emerged, and then I decided to launch this fund. Should I talk a bit about that?
I'll come back to that later. Maybe just how we got to meet. A common friend of both of ours, Stephen Shen, yes. Put together a group chat, I think really at the start of the corona crisis, and I think you and me and many of us in that chat became good friends really virtually just through participating in that chat.
Absolutely. Our friend Stephen was an absolute savant at cutting the COVID numbers every which way in the US and China and so on, and so that chat was instrumental in helping our investing during that time. And through that, I met Rob, and then we finally met up in person, I think at Berkshire in 2022. Since then, I've been meeting Rob in all these unexpected places in New York, at the Basic Fit Investor Day in Amsterdam, where he brought his son, and now here. And so it's great to see you so many times, yeah.
Yeah, well, it's great to have you here, Tim. Fred, same question to you.
Yeah, does it work?
Yeah. Well,
thanks for having me, Rob. So I'm Fred. I'm 40, married with three young kids. I guess I'm the youngish part of your introduction.
Anything below 50 is young from my perspective.
I was actually born and raised in this glorious country, so I'm always very happy to come back to my home country. I mean, Oxidus, which is the name of my fund, has been a very long-term project in the making, something because I got bit by the bug of investing in my teens, started to invest when I was 15, which is the first legal age in the canton of Geneva, where I was born and raised, where I asked my parents a waiver to be able to invest in the stock market, and you know that made me more focused on achieving the right steps along the way to build my path to set up Oxidus. So you know, I've always worked in London, so I started my career in London, and I've been in London for almost two decades now, starting in investment banking, then in private equity, then in a hedge fund world at Soros, and then in an investment partnership called Dynamo in London before launching in Q1 2021. So that's pretty much it.
Congratulations to you as well.
Thank you.
So thank you for being here. It's a pleasure to be sitting in these seats where so many great investors have been sitting. My name is Joan Esteve Manasang. I am from Barcelona, and I'm the manager of a concentrated hedge fund we just launched last year, which was a restructuring of a UCITS fund I had launched in 2017. I'm currently the investment officer of a family-owned asset management company from Barcelona, which is owned by the Torrella family, who is one of the investors supporting our project. And I'm an independent asset manager since 2015, where I started 2 years managing private accounts. And then in 2017, we launched a UCITS fund, an own UCITS fund, in which legally I was the asset, the fund advisor, because that structure was cheaper. And the asset management company who was doing all the administration was like the one that was doing all the management of the administration, basically. And this UCITS fund was launched as a UCITS structure because the initial investors, which is something very important when you start, that had the right mindset of long-term investment and permanent capital, they required the UCITS structure because they were investing through a UCITS funds, so they required that UCITS structure. After 4 years in which the management and the profitability of the fund was nice, we transferred, or we started the transfer of the with the transition of the UCITS fund to a hedge fund, right? Which in Spain the name is a Fondo de Inversión Libre. And to have the freedom to concentrate in the best ideas. Because during the 4 years and a half we have been managed the UCITS fund, we were doing a parallel management, virtual parallel management, of what was the real drag that was having on our investment way or investment process. having the obligation to be invested in more than 16 or 20.
I think it's a motivation for a lot of managers is to find a sort of a concentrated structure early on.
Because...
So I'll maybe ask you just to pause there, because that was going to be my next question anyway to all of you. Maybe starting with Fred this time, which is, there's this incredible chicken and an egg dilemma when you get started. Typically people will say to you, to start a fund, you need at least $10 million dollars of capital. And of course, unless you have a rich uncle or aunt or something, most people wouldn't have that kind of money. So it's very difficult to get a fund started. So I'd be curious to ask each of you how you kind of solve that sort of problem.
Luck, I would say. No, but I mean, there's no right or wrong answer. You're absolutely right. I mean, I'll just talk for myself, but that's not an advice.
We're here to hear your story, sir.
Yeah. So in my case, the reason I say luck is, if you think of essentially the three hats that one needs to wear if you want to launch your own fund, everybody knows the first one, which is the CIO hat, right? So the CIO, PM, analyst, whatever you want to call it. Then there's a second one, which is the CEO hat. I mean, you're running essentially a small business. And then there's a third one, which is essentially, I mean, it depends for some people. Some people would hire someone to do it. I do it myself, which is to manage the relationship with your partners, right? So you need to think, and it's equally important to think about these three hats, right? And when I wanted to start, essentially, I went around to ask my friends that did it successfully, but also unsuccessfully, because, I mean, what you notice, like in all walks in life, is that people that are successful for different reasons, but people that fail, sadly fail for the same reason. So, like, I tend to be a half-empty type of guy. So that's what I focused on. And what I noticed is that usually people would tend to fail not because of the first hat, but because of the second and the third hat. Because most people that would tend to go down that route, we tend to be focused on the first hat, but and they do not necessarily enjoy the second and the third one. So when you think about building that path, you need to think about these three hats equally importantly, and to really build your path along these three axes. Which brings me to the chicken and the egg problem, which is down to the third hat, which, by my own admission, which is why I say it's luck, is the one that I did not necessarily spend enough time on. The reason I was lucky is because I had a friend, who very successfully launched, and who was at Dynamo with me, and who very successfully launched a fund a few years before me. And I did a few reference calls for him with very prestigious institutions, so mostly US endowments, single family office, and foundations. And one of them, actually, or a few of them, actually, were not able to, he had a good problem. He had too much money being thrown at him. Yeah. So there were a few people that, left empty-handed. And so my first port of call was very simplistically, one of the guys that I did the reference calls with, and they ended up being our anchor investor. And so that's how we solved the chicken and the egg, which is why I say, it's no advice or whatever. The advice is more like, you should think about it much more than I did, and not just be lucky as I was.
I'm curious about the next two answers, but I think the element of luck is always a really important part, but part of luck is also putting yourself in the right place. So clearly you did that.
Yes. So, I mean, here, I think it's very important in the sense that when you try to do pattern recognition on the investment partnership and the manager that I admired in London or globally, right? And I will not name names, but some of them very, very large. You would notice, some pattern is that there is, I don't know how you say it in English, but kind of affiliation, in the sense that usually they would be people that have, being surrounded, so being taught by the right teachers, being surrounded by the right mentors. And that's something that is within your control. So, I mean,
that's
clearly.
That's a great point, yeah.
So, and I think it's very important. In my case, certainly, my teachers at at First Reserve, Mark, you know, Igor, at Soros, obviously Bruno, at Dynamo, and then all of the others, mentors, have been really, really helpful. So that's, you're right, that's within your control, and that's something that is...
Let me ask you to pause there, and I'll pass over the mic to Juan, and maybe Juan, you can talk about your hedge fund or your current structure and how that kind of came about, and or whichever you think was the most important sort of relationship and that sort of pathway you described in your last answer.
Well, it's fundamental to have the support if you don't have a wealth on your own to launch these structures, right? So it was a key part in my case that one of the investors of my initial UCITS fund had a family-owned asset management company who wanted to support the transition to a hedge fund, to a more, let's say, unconstrained, flexible, and for someone who is investing, looking at the fundamentals of the company, can just focus on the best investments with less risk, let's say. More control on what you're investing at. And I think that was fundamental to having a support of some family offices, which had already been invested with you for a while, for a long time. And the contacts of these people came from different places. One is a contact from the London Business School, which I studied at. And another is a very successful entrepreneur, let's say, from my region, which I met through my sister. And the other is the Torreya family, which were investing in my initial fund, and they have this asset management company. So these are three of the examples of how you can find investors who have the same mindset as you.
Perfect. And Tim, the same question to you.
About the chicken and egg, right? Rob, I found your letter to independent fund managers absolutely crucial for me to think about this problem. So I think 10 years ago, Rob wrote a letter to aspiring hedge investment managers, and he had like 10 bullet points of advice. And I think I've read it like 5 or 10 times since then. I think I read it when it came out, and then I'm going back to it over and over again. And it was enormously encouraging because Rob laid out in clear terms that the reality that emerging managers may face. So one of the points was like, don't market because no one will invest. And I saw that, and it made a lot of sense and reconciled my experience. Like when you're a new manager without much track record, without a team, with a very small AUM, the only people investing in you are going to be close friends and family, and so you should focus on the performance of the fund more than anything. Rob, you had this amazing line that I think about a lot, which is there's no shortage of demand for managers with a credible strategy who can turn 50 cents into dollars. And if you can do that, then the money will come, the AUM will come later. And so that looking at that line is like enormously encouraging because like you're small now, but just focus on the returns. So for me, the chicken and egg problem is not solved. There's no chicken yet, but Rob's path lays out a clear way to get there. I think Rob's example and also our friend Steven's example, just like starting from very small amounts and then scaling from there, I think it's a dramatic contrast to the traditional model where you raise 100, 200 million, you have a hot team, you have a couple years to have good returns or you shut down. And that's the complete opposite. And so knowing about that, like seeing someone doing that was very valuable. So yeah, thank you, Rob, for writing that. Thank you, and thank you for the mentorship.
Thank you, Tim, for your generous comments. I really appreciate it. So I'm going to ask one last question, and I think I'll hand over the mics will start going around so you can ask your questions. If each of you could just briefly, in maybe two or three sentences, describe the legal structure you invest through. And the point of that is not to get into a legal discussion now. I think we'll lose half the audience if we do that. But just so people who come from the same geography and are thinking about structures and stuff can then reach out to you guys maybe offline to kind of discuss that. So Tim, why don't you go first on this one?
Again, this is taking inspiration from like the simplicity. And so I'm in the US. I set it up as a very simple fund. It's a Delaware LLC, so a US-based LLC. And later on, you can always attach it, Cayman Islands master feeder structure off to it, for which many institutional investors and foreign investors will want. But initially, it's just like a very simple structure. And then happy to chat with anyone about the vendors I used. I think I found that vendors often cost significantly less than I expected before looking into it. And you can always find cheap but pretty good vendors. And so the list of like administrators, prime brokers are happy to talk to anyone about
it. And just very briefly as well, just in terms of cost ballpark, are we talking thousands of dollars to set something like this up, tens of thousands, even hundreds of thousands? What, just very approximate ballpark?
So legal fees to set something up from a reputable law firm, I think, will be $40,000, like a one-time fee, which you can charge to the fund. And the law allows you to amortize that over 60 months. And so in theory, it's a charge to the fund. And then ongoing expenses, administrator, for example, was $6,000 a year, way cheaper than I expected. Prime broker is quote-unquote free, but you're paying through trading. Some of the biggest expenses were like audit and tax. Those really run up to the, call it like 20, 30K range. But if you add it all up, not including the initial upfront cost of the $40,000, I think you can do like 50, 60K of like annual expense.
That's awesome. Thank you so much. Yeah, Fred, maybe the same question to you. Thanks.
So for us, we have Cayman Master Fund with an offshore feeder. And investment management agreement with a management company based in London, authorized and regulated by the FCA. So similar to
similar TM. Cost and on-run cost.
It's a bit more expensive.
Yeah.
Obviously, the reason we set it up that way is mainly for the type of partners that we cater to. We were lucky to have, you know, from day one, institutional, very prestigious US-based investors, and that's usually the kind of structure that they expect, and that's still, you know, and that matches very well with the type of mandate that we have. In terms of cost, I mean, the cost to set up the legal structure. By the way, never believe, and sorry, I know you picked on the lawyers yesterday, but never believe what the bills of the lawyers would say. Always put a cap. You will always hit the cap, no matter what you say. But the cost of the legal structure, so for the Cayman Master Fund plus the offshore feeder, you're talking about $100, again, charged to the fee, amortized over 60 months. If you wanted to add a Delaware feeder, which is for taxable investors, so U.S. taxable investors, that would be another 15, so 15K, which you don't need at the beginning, and you can still have taxable investor investing in the offshore structure and having a PFIC, but I will not get into the specifics here. And then setting up the management company in London legally, I mean, you're talking about, I'd say, 10 to 15, again. So that's broadly the cost. I will ask you about your fund admin because mine is slightly more expensive than that.
That's good if we can get a better deal from service providers out of this meeting.
And my hedge fund is incorporated in Spain, which is a cheaper jurisdiction than other places, and also had some fiscal advantages for Spanish investors. So basically, it's unconstrained and long-only hedge fund, which the legal term is Fondo de Inversión Libre. And it's not very easy to get the approval, so you need to have some people who has already had experience on this kind of hedge funds for the regulator to prove it, for example. So you need
cost roughly set up, if you don't mind saying?
The cost setup should be something between 15,000 and 20,000.
Okay, makes sense, yeah. And I'm gonna ask actually one more question before I let the mics go around, but I see the time is racing, so try and be as quick as you can. Just briefly describe your strategies, the way you invest. Juan, do you wanna go first on that one? Or? If you could just describe your investment strategy in two or three sentences, yeah.
Okay. Basically, I try to specialize in finding what I call the successful business models, and then to see where in which industries, in which sectors, and which companies to apply those business, successful business models. You know, these successful business models are business models that are designed by the managers. So in this investment philosophy, looking at the management actions is very important, management mindset that allow you to have long-term returns over above average and in a structural growth sector.
Perfect. Just in the interest of time, I'll stop you there, and then we're going to go for the questions. So, Fred?
Yeah, so Oxidus is an investment partnership focused solely on Europe with a very strong bias to small and mid-caps. We tend to apply a quote-unquote, sorry about that, private equity approach to public markets. So that's research intensive, long-term, concentrated with a constructive approach with management, with a very specific focus on paradigm shifts within the industries or companies that we tend to invest in, as well as temporary woes, with a strong focus on structural market inefficiencies, and intangible features of the companies that we invest in within very specific clusters, and again, just in Europe.
Perfect. While Tim has a chance to formulate his response, if Tommy and Olivia are here, oh, you have the microphones? Great, so we're all set for when the Q&A starts. Okay.
And my fund is a global long-only fund. So the strategy is to focus on companies with amazing products, products that customers love, that add a lot of value to customers, that have really high NPS. Kind of like some of your investments, like Ryman Healthcare and things like that. I really like that type of investment. It comes from studying Bezos and the obsession with the customer, and also from studying these Chinese companies that, if just from surveying, there's no large Chinese company that has a bad product and skates by on pricing power and switching costs and so on. They all focus on the customer, because if you don't obsess on the customer in China, you're going to die. And so I'm trying to apply that globally.
Perfect. Thank you so much. There's one other microphone here. So do you have two? Oh, you have two. Perfect. Okay, then we can keep it as it is. So who would like to ask the first question? I think there's one just at the back there.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for taking the time. Quick question. How did you all think about potentially getting help on the operations and, in Fred's words, the CEO side, so that you can focus as much of your time as possible on the investing side?
Yeah, thanks for the question, Gabe. So again, you know, there's no right or wrong here. Some people would go the outsourced route for the operations. I personally went in sourcing day one. But again, you know, that was allowed by our partners, I'd say. And so when I talk about the three hats, I spend, when I think about the three hats, I spend, you know, most of my time on the first hat, and I'm very lucky that I have Kelly, who must be watching, because I was telling Rob that I needed to be careful for compliance reasons about what I say. You know, that takes care of everything from operations, infrastructure, compliance point of view. So I literally, and it's funny because what you ask is essentially one of the pitfalls, is that the guys that, you know, had regrets were around the operation because they underestimated the amount of time, depending on the jurisdictions that you're in, but certainly in London, and I guess maybe for you in New York, I mean, that's very cumbersome. And so having someone full-time that, you know, you trust and you know that there's not going to be any hiccups from an operations trade reconciliation perspective, and that you have kind of a gold standard infrastructure, is very reassuring and helps you really focus your time where the return on time is going to be the greatest. That being said, I know some managers that are, you know, that have outsourced operations and it's working.
Are either the other two doing outsourced or, yeah? Why don't you say quickly about outsourced, and then unless you have a strong point of view, Juan, we'll move on to the next question, and I'll let you answer that one.
I think it goes back to, like, if you have a simple strategy, you're going to have simple operations. If you have a complex strategy, you're going to have complex operations. So if you have a long-short strategy, a lot of shorts, then you're going to be dealing with trade breaks, locating borrow, and different prime brokers and all sorts of headaches. For me, as a long only, just buying stocks, then it simplifies the operations a lot. And on outsourcing, so I have an outsourced CFO, costs about 20K a year, and they help with the managing your management company tax books, helping check your NAV every month for the fund and various things like that, and it saves quite a bit of time. But overall, I thought the operations burden, at least for a fund my size and with my strategy, was not as high as I might have expected.
Perfect. Great. Who'd like to ask the next question?
One at the front here. And then this.
Hi, I'm Arnie from Italy. So being an investor requires a constant evolution in terms of investment thinking, philosophy. But on the other hand, when you sell a strategy, you need to be very clear in order to sell. So I wonder, is a selling a strategy somehow a limit to your personal growth as an investor? Thank you.
Well, I love that question. That's great. Juan, why don't you go first this time?
Well, I fully agree with you. So you have to be consistent in your investment style because your investors expect something that you have been telling them how you do select the investments, right? And the kind of investments you are investing at or in. So you have to be consistent, but you have that flexibility to be able to explain to your investors when you find a great investment opportunity in a field that is not the classical one you have been doing. And also you go learning, like Rob did in his 5-year, 10-year, 15-year letters. I mean, you expand and you grow your circle of competence. You learn more industries. You learn more investment opportunities. You start finding value in long-term compounders that you couldn't see before, you know, or you can see some short-term opportunities from a catalyst in a very specific company that you feel is very rewarding and you can take it. So you have to, don't deviate, so basically you have to follow, to be consistent, but you have that flexibility with your investors and with communication to tell them, look, it's in the benefit of all of us to, or I've been learning, I've been growing, and I also can see these opportunities, and I can then add them sporadically, or maybe it will be something that will maybe become consistent. It's very, very attractive. So
that's awesome. Thank you. Do either of you two want to say something to that, or should we give some, try and get more questions in? Okay. Who'd like to ask the next question? Claudine?
Hi, good morning, thanks very much. I'm interested in your motivation because I'm sure all of you would be able to earn a very good living working for someone else. So what cost benefit do you do when you decide to go out on your own? I mean, you Fred, has 3 small kids. What did your wife, partner say, you know, about you giving that up to start off on your own? And you know, how you see the risks versus the opportunities and the reasons that you're taking that on?
Who wants to have a crack at that one?
Thanks for the question. I think it's a very fair one. I mean, I remember when I essentially started, like a number of US LPs were telling me, I don't understand why there's not more partnerships like that in doing what you do in Europe versus the US. To which I answered, you know, speaking to all of my friends, you know, at the Hengistbury, the TCI of the world, the Edgerton of the world, where I'm like, yeah, you're absolutely right. The risk reward is not worth it if you only think about money. So you don't do it if you only think about money, because if you have a very good job in a very strong and performing partnership, then it doesn't make sense. You need to do it because you want to do something else. You want to do something on your own. I mean, an investor
probably
actually...
Be independent as well, like, and make your own decisions.
Yeah, and an investor asked me actually a very good question, which was, what would you do if you weren't doing what you were doing, like, in that industry? And I think it's a question about your identity and what you're trying to do. I mean, in my case, and again, no advice, I see myself as a builder, so I would have built and you know, something else in a different industry. So I guess you're right, it's not about money, it's about doing what you want to do, it's about building something that resemble what you do. Because as I said, for me, you know, one of the learning has been the path that you're taking, the teachers and the mentors that you surround yourself with. But there are things that you're gonna take, you know, that you're gonna learn from them that apply to you, and some that you don't necessarily want to apply to yourself. And so you want to build some, so people that would do it for me would build something that essentially is like them and is also resemblant of their path. But again, it's very personal, but you're right. I don't think it's about money, because otherwise you just stay in a cushy job in one of these high performing investment partnership.
Great. I think we've got an online question, so Nick, over to you.
Hey everybody. This is for anyone who wants to take a crack at it, but how do you think about finding the right partners for you that are aligned with your strategy and what you're doing, especially at the beginning when it might be hard to find partners?
Tim, do you want to have a crack at that one? Or if you need some more time to think, I can let someone else have a go. Joanne?
So you can find two kinds of partners, I would say. One is the economical partner, the capital partner, and the other is just someone who you co-manage a fund, for example. So I think it's something very personal, and it depends on whether you want to make a project on your own or you want to share that project with someone else. Right, I think that is the main thing, and I would say for the capital partners, they should be, you know, people who you can, they trust you, because in the end you are giving them returns, but you are also, they are buying trust, right? And they have to be people who trust you, and trust, building trust takes time, and then it's also that they have to have this mindset of long-term investment. So they have to be wealthy people, which they will not need that money in 3, 2, or 5 years, maybe, right? So they can become a part of the growing part of the project.
Perfect. Tim, do you want to say something to that?
I think for me, it's for this question is more about the reverse, like what kind of partners do you not want to have? I have a clear thing in mind of that, and so, some of the things Rob talked about in his letter, which I completely agree with, is like people who want a share of the economics for some money in the upfront, people who you know are going to be fast money, or are going to be really like on your ass, like monthly returns, and something goes wrong, get a ton of questions. I think if you exclude those, then I think you're going to have good partners.
Great answer, I love it. I think we have time for one last question. I warned you guys it would go by very quickly once it gets started. Who'd like to ask the last question? Well, I guess I'll ask the last question then if no one else wants to. So where do you guys all want to be in 10 years' time? And maybe each of you could answer that. Yeah, start with you, Juan.
So my friend was saying, you are already living on the beach. What do you want to do in 10 years, right? So no, in 10 years' time, I would just have made a lot of progress in my investment process, I would say, in how to select business. And basically the goal that was asked before for me was to being the owner of great businesses and being able to grow my wealth through being the owner of great businesses, and also the intellectual challenge of an intellectual pleasure of this job is very, very important for me. I'm also the teacher at university because, you know, I've always liked this cultural and this intellectual challenge, pleasure in my life. And basically in 10 years' time, I would see like myself like with a, you know, more well-known fund in which more people has been able to take advantage of a better management. That's
perfect. Good luck with that. Tim, do you want to go next?
I think the value of like being your own manager, and this ties into the earlier question about why start a fund, is like every investor has a different personality, and when you work for someone else, you in some sense have to conform to parts of his personality and how you invest and constrain how you invest. And when you have your own fund, you get to fully express your personality and really lean into the way you think, the way you invest. And so in 10 years, I hope to be doing same thing I'm doing now, just with more scale, and so I can meet with more management teams and have more research calls, but investing the way I want and in a structure where decision-making can concentrate at the top, still with me, and looking at the world that way.
Perfect. And Fred?
Yeah, I guess a continuation of, you know, what we said today. I mean, for me, it's just about continuing to build, again, along the three hats, constantly improving, obviously on the second and on the third one. So on the second one, obviously, I want to grow the team, and when we're going to hire one or two investment analysts and hopefully soon partners this year, and kind of growth still to be manageable. So I have kind of a rule of thumb for the three hats, in the sense that I know you talk about your 10 companies. I mean, I'm more like 10 to 15, but like, if you see there's a rule of thumb between the three hats, in the sense that even in like the company, I don't think I would want to manage more than 10 people in total, and that includes operations. And then, you know, also in terms of the number of LP relationship, also having something that is manageable, and still doing what I love. So I guess, you know, very similar to what was said, doing what we love with a bit more scale and sharing it with more partners.
Well, I think all three of you, your passion for investing really comes through. Great to see you got started. The best of luck for the next 10 years. And thank you for your kind offer to anyone else here in the audience or watching on YouTube to be able to reach out to you. So thank you, all of you.